event, so we'll move straight on to Peter,
and then we'll have questions. Thank you.
I'll try to keep this shorter. So in full disclosure, I have known Stuart for about 25 years when I met him at one of the annual meetings of the Society for American Archaeology, shortly after the first edition of his Cambridge Press book on Prehistory of the Americas came out, and I complained that he cut the Caribbean short shrift. You heard Brian introduce me, I'm a Caribbeanist. So anyways, that was a long time ago. But I will come back to the Caribbean later. It's the center of the universe. But first, the matter at hand. In my comments, I'm going to address some of the challenges in identifying first colonizers to new places, especially in the context of small-scale pre-industrial societies. In these kinds of colonization or migration events, it's highly unlikely that we're dealing with movements of large groups of people at the same time. So Stuart talked about maybe 150-person macro bands. That might even be too many. One thing about Fidel is that he wants to see evidence in good context, you heard all about that, before making grand conclusions about the course of human history, or not so grand conclusions about some aspect of data and interpretations of them. Something that's becoming a rarity in much of today's world of postmodern archaeology, where data are more of a sideshow to ideas. That said, I do have some comments, Stuart. One of the films I show in my intro to archaeology class has a young Dennis Stanford, where the Clovis point is pointing, bemoaning the fact that pre-Clovis people may have occupied dramatically older landforms than the later Clovis people, and that archaeologists haven't been looking in the right places for these older sites. Therefore, one problem, he said, is that for years we've been looking on 11,000-year-old terraces, and what have we been finding? 11,000-year-old sites. Isn't that odd, Dennis observed. Nobody has been walking 40,000-year-old terraces because man just wasn't here 40,000 years ago. When we start walking these older terraces, maybe we'll find what we're looking for, suggested Stanford. By the end of the movie, young Dennis acknowledged that the Lewisville site in Texas unfortunately could not be definitively placed in the pre-Clovis era, but he's not giving up. And after serious and deliberate research continued, looking in the right places for pre-Clovis occupations, and none are found, then Dennis said, we will have demonstrated that probably Clovis man was the first here, but we'll never know for sure, ever. Stanford's beard is white now, and he's looking now, and he's still looking, and now has pre-Clovis people producing lancelet-shaped salutrium points. I just have to get back to the Caribbean for... So we do have this one stem point from Trinidad, just close to South America. Maybe we have a Paleo-Indian in the Caribbean. Unfortunately, this point was found by a schoolboy in the backyard of the school, so could have been dropped by a tourist who happened to be visiting Venezuela. I don't know. In regard to the possibility of a Pacific coastal route of pre-Clovis people, Stuart points out the troubling fact that no coastal sites have been identified predating 13,200 Cal years before present. Post-glacial relative sea level changes vary across the planet. However, based on glacial isostatic adjustment modeling studies, we can generally say that sea levels were approximately 2 meters lower than today, around 4,000 Cal before present, 4 meters lower around 5,000 Cal BP, 8 meters lower 7,000 Cal BP, and 13 meters lower around 8,000 Cal BP. Here's two maps of the Caribbean, of Cuba, one today, the lower map about 5,000 BP, more or less. So you see the shoreline has changed quite a bit. If there were coastal sites on the coast of Cuba, 5,000 Cal BP, they're underwater now. So sea level change needs to be factored into expectations of coastal site locations dating to early and mid-post-Pleistocene eras. If people were traveling along the pre-13,200 Cal BP Pacific coastline, archaeological traces of those people may have been inundated long ago. Depending on seafloor topography and CalBP age, there is the potential for submerged early post-Pleistocene landscapes and the sites associated with the ancient coastline. Regarding the more mature Dennis Stanford and Bruce Bradley and the Solutrean connection, I am again inclined to agree with Stewart's interpretation. But if Solutrean people paddled over to North America from Iberia starting around 19,000 CalBP and were thriving on exposed landscapes that make up the continental shelf, then archaeological evidence of them may be under meters of marine sediments. Paleontological remains of terrestrial mammals, including toxodons and stegomastodons, have been retrieved by fishermen at depths exceeding 20 meters and great distances from the current shoreline of southeastern Brazil. Elsewhere around the world, fossil terrestrial mammals have been collected from the continental shelves of the Sea of Japan, northeastern North America, the North Sea, Argentina, and Uruguay. Dates of these remains range from 650 to 18,000 years ago and overlap with Dennis's purported Solutrean connection. Sea level was a good 120 meters lower than today's during the last glacial maximum, so if there were coastally oriented people cavorting some miles east of present-day New England, then evidence for them is going to be hard to find. This would require examining bathymetric maps and sea level curves in connection with specific areas along old coastlines and conducting underwater surveys, a daunting enterprise. Clovis Point Dillehay. I found Stewart's critique of the Monte Verde project to be compelling. However, in the spirit of critique on critique, I have questions. Stewart says that Stone Age sites should always have debitage. We do know that highly mobile people were necessarily and keenly aware of details of their landscapes. Imagine a highly mobile group of Stone Age people. Are they going to schlep kilos of rock to manufacture tools as they need them? Unlikely. Plenty of archaeological and ethnographic studies show that people will rough out and reduce to manageable sizes and weights stone tools at the quarry location and then move on. Some years ago, I directed excavations of a prehistoric quarry site in the Lehigh Valley of southeastern Pennsylvania, the lower of the two archaeological sites depicted there, is located along a vein of Pennsylvania jasper. This site was a source of high-quality Pennsylvania jasper. We recovered great amounts of large jasper decortication flakes, jasper blocky fragments, jasper cores, and battered hammer stones. However, we did not find a single finished jasper biface, projectile point, spear point, or uniface. We did recover a handful of non-jasper points, but no flakes of those materials, and every one of the points was transversely snapped across the blade, the argillite point on the right. Our conclusion, as mobile bands of Stone Age hunters, gatherers, foragers, collectors used up their stone tools, they knew where toolkits could be replenished. Not so astounding. In retooling with jasper, in the case of our quarry, people disposed of their junky, non-jasper tools they had been carrying around, thus accounting for the lack of non-jasper debitage and great amounts of jasper debitage. In the case of the purported pre-Clovis Monteverde village, the lack of macro debitage could be related to the same kind of mobility strategy we documented in the Lehigh Valley. Stewart's right, though. It would be a strange group of Stone Age people who did not resharpen tools, and therefore we should expect there to be micro debitage. Finding micro debitage is easier said than done, and without an aggressive and systematic program of flotation, it's unlikely that these small rejuvenation flakes will be found in standard quarter-inch mesh sifters. According to the Monteverde report, flotation was employed in the collection of botanical remains, so if micro debitage was present, it should have been reported and thus reported on. Stewart points out that none of the other early Paleo-Indian sites in the Southern Cone have assemblages similar to Monteverde. However, if Monteverde really contains an early pre-Clovis occupation, perhaps these people followed a completely different technological tradition than what we're used to for later early Paleo-Indians. Like young Dennis Stanford said in his quest for pre-Clovis, we just don't know what we're looking for in pre-Clovis assemblages. I think the most damning assertion on the part of Stewart's critique of a pre-Clovis presence at Monteverde is the observation that the handful of indubitable artifacts lack verifiable provenience and no mapping of their context. That's not very good archaeology. On Cactus Hill, Stewart makes the reasonable observation that downward drift of artifacts from an overlying Clovis horizon is to be expected in the sandy soils that make up the site's matrix. My only question is how to account for the approximately 40 centimeters of artifact-free sediment that Goodyear reported between the Clovis and purported pre-Clovis deposits. Regarding Stewart's critique of pre-Clovis occupations in Paisley Caves, he questions how two distinct groups with similar lake-oriented foraging adaptations and toolkits could have coexisted for several centuries without competitive exclusion. One response to that query is that perhaps they were not separate groups. We know from ethnographic investigations of foraging groups that people move around landscapes of varying geographic scales as needed and appropriate, and leave relative degrees of similar versus distinctive assemblages that form the archaeological record. In his famous Archaeology of Place studies, Benford long ago emphasized the importance of interassemblage variability in coming to grips with the reality of human behavior, especially in the context of foraging adaptations and the associated challenges in interpreting the archaeological record. Stewart's discussion of mammoth butchery, a spike in charcoal particulates seen in the paleoecological record, and early human predation around 14,700 cal before present in the Midwest and southern New York is important. I want to use his discussion as a point of departure in considering the processes of first colonization to new places. And Stewart talked a little about it, although he's not very happy about it, apparently. In terms of underlying processes, especially in pre-industrial settings, it makes more sense to view migration as a series of non-mutually exclusive pulses or small-scale excursions rather than as distinct population waves riding on the backs of big directional arrows. In the band-based social context of the first peopling of the Americas, exploratory forays by small groups of people may have been made as additive processes of landscape learning. As camps and settlements were established by these pioneers or scouts, lines of communication were maintained with homeland communities. In early human America, lines of communications between pioneering settlements and homelands may have been sustained and managed through overlapping and cross-cutting exchange and social networks. Measuring colonization pulses archaeologically is a challenge, given the small numbers of people that may have been involved and the scant material cultural remains they left behind. The paleoecological record may be a more reliable or observable view of otherwise nearly indiscernible traces. And Stewart pointed to that pollen diagram that was very compelling in that regard and showing when the charcoal peaks started coming in and the decrease in the fungal spores. As people set foot on new landscapes, modifications were made to them, if for no other reason than clearing vegetation for shelters. These modifications are likely to show up in microbotanical records with qualitative and quantitative shifts in pollen and phytolith assemblages and concentrations of charcoal microparticulates. In her investigations of early occupations in Mesoamerica, Mary Pohl and colleagues lamented the spotty preservation and recovery of macrobotanical remains and noted that paleoecological studies are often more reliable than traditional archaeological investigations in identifying human occupations. Likewise, back to the Caribbean, in discussing early occupations in the Caribbean, David Burney indicated that small, low-density groups of people resulted in a thin archaeological record compared to larger, more settled communities, and that pollen and charcoal analysis may be a better way to discern initial colonization events, and the resultant often subtle impacts to landscapes. In their overview of subsistence and migration patterns among small-scale societies, Stephen Foley and others in a recent issue of the Anthropocene, observed that the paucity of archaeological sites is a major obstacle in accurately understanding the dynamics of early settlement and subsistence strategies. Paleoecological investigations worldwide are revealing the importance of systematically collecting microfossils from sedimentary deposits to identify past human activities that are not well represented archaeologically. In terms of colonization processes and issues of landscape learning, I would argue that initial humanization of new places is linked directly to broad-spectrum systems adaptations. Regarding first colonization of the Americas, Paleo-Indians were traditionally linked to a focal subsistence economy specialized to big game hunting. This view, however, may have been skewed by preservational bias in the form of spectacular lithic assemblages and faunal remains of large animals. Older excavations that did not use fine sieving techniques and flotation reinforced such conceptions. With the use of more rigorous recovery methods, it now appears that the earliest colonists to the Americas, in fact, relied on a broad range of plant and animal resources depending on characteristics of local habitats. The broad-spectrum subsistence adaptation linked to specific characteristics and taxonomic diversity of local habitats may be thought of as a form of some mix of opportunistic foraging, collecting, hunting, and fishing. When appropriate recovery methods were employed, the oldest known Pleistocene sites in the Bismarck and Solomon Islands of the Pacific also revealed subsistence strategies based on a broad range of terrestrial and marine resources, including plants and animals. Similar observations concerning diverse resource sets have been made for Neolithic and pre-Neolithic or epipaleolithic occupations in the Mediterranean. I'm going to skip a little bit here. And so here's the end. Could the young Dennis Stanford 35 years ago have been right? We're the first Americans different enough from the later Clovis people that we just don't know what we're looking for, we're not looking in the right places, and we're not employing the appropriate field methods to find them. Stewart gave us a persuasive argument from multiple lines of evidence for why Clovis people were the first ones here. And given the current nature of the database, I agree with him. However, I think that with more aggressive and systematic field studies like in paleoecology and underwater surveys, maybe one day we'll have a different picture of who the first Americans were and when they got here. Or maybe not.
Thank you, Peter, for your very interesting comments. Right now we're going to open up the floor to question and answer. So if we can invite Stuart to come up here to field questions. Maybe you'd like to call him yourself. Yes, over here.
No, it was excavated. Actually, this is a little known fact that you can find if you read Dillehay's report closely. There was a Chilean named Troncoso who had been digging there, actually laid out some units, and was finding mastodon or gomphothere bones, and then found a lithic. He found that there was that one sort of rougher-looking biface, and when Dillehay saw that, he got involved and somehow kind of elbowed Troncoso out of the picture, and then the other lithics turned up, as well as some other pieces of wood that are interpreted as artifacts.
Turned up and stratified.
They turned up on the floor of that site. I mean, where they came exactly, who can say, because they don't appear in any of the maps. Oh, yes.
You raised an interesting point about Siberia at one point, which had a rather complex technology, and North America. Is it possible that mastodons continued on in Siberia for a considerably longer period, and it was better for paleo hunters in Siberia than...
Not mastodon, because mastodon are restricted to more southern North American environments. But there was mammoth, there was horse, there was, what else, muskox. Actually, there's a kind of interesting parallel to the thing that Peter and I were sort of jousting a bit about as far as the signals of presence, because the last fossils in Alaska, the eastern end of Beringia, date to, the last mammoths are about 11,600 radiocarbon years. The last horse are about 12,000 radiocarbon years. But in 10,000-year-old sediments, DNA has been reported of those animals. So there may be animals around that we're not seeing the bones of for 2,000 years. And that's kind of troubling.
In the New York Times about 3 days ago, a mastodon bone was found near the Ob River in Siberia, and DNA was extracted from it. Did you see that?
No.
It's an article in Science.
Well, there's been a lot of DNA coming out of different mammoths, very well-preserved DNA. And, you know, cloning is not impossible. I mean, in 20 years maybe. It might be the technology to do that. I should add, though, another important point. There are two islands, Wrangel Island off of the north coast of Siberia and St. Paul Island off Alaska, where there are very late-occurring small mammoths down to about 3,500 years ago, which I think is a good case for the human effect on the mainland mammoths, because those are places that humans didn't get to. Same way in the Caribbean, there are large ground sloths that last down to about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. Again, people didn't get there. Everywhere else in the Americas where there were big ground sloths, people wiped them out at 12,800, 12,700 years ago.
So people got to the Caribbean, just 4,000 or 5,000.
Right. People arrive, end of the ground sloths. Not a surprise. In the back.
A few years ago, in the Museum of Natural History, was a great exhibition. It was a Pajuerca. And they showed that every 20 years, 15 years, was waves of immigration. But why you concentrate what happened 14,500 years ago? And you try and convince us that this was last wave, and I would say Russian Siberian came to America, and this last picture was they were very happy. Yeah, and second speaker. And my question is why? What happened for 14,500 years ago, because Atapuerca showed...
Well, Atapuerca is a much older site.
...us that this was wave, like pendulum, maybe.
Well,
maybe 40,000 years ago was migration from America to Russia.
There's actually a semi-crazy guy that you can see a blog of online named Germont Zibel, who argues that Homo sapiens originated in the Americas and went back across the Bering Strait into Asia. There are too many problems to even begin to discuss that point of view, but let me say this. There are two separate issues in looking at American archaeology, early American archaeology. One is, who were the ancestors of present Native Americans? And the other is, who were the first hominins in the Americas? Now, it's possible... You may not know this, but the standard explanation of how monkeys got to South America is that they rafted over from Africa about 35, 37 million years ago. All right? I mean, there were proto-lemurs, let's call them, in the Americas, prosimians, way back into the late Cretaceous. But the monkeys, based on genetic and morphological evidence, branched from a common ancestor out of Africa. So the South American monkeys are... somehow transatlantic migrants. Now, if monkeys could float across, maybe some West African Australopithecines could float across. But if they did, that's not the ancestry of modern Native Americans, which is traceable by a lot of new molecular genetic data to North Asia and on the order of 15,000 years. Yes?
You use molecular DNA and physical anthropological evidence. And I wondered if you considered historical linguistics of the type that Joseph Greenberg...
Yes.
How that fits with what you're discussing.
Greenberg and his protege, Merritt Rulin, thought that they saw some very simple linguistic particles that were evidence of a common Amerindian language that was from one common ancestry and distinct from Athapascan and Inuit languages. Problem is, I've actually looked a lot at linguistic data, particularly on the question of the movements of the Algonquians at a much later date. Once you get back beyond about 10,000 years, the noise of sort of accidental resemblance can drown out the real signal of linguistic relationship. And we're talking about 14,000-year-old events here. So I think we're just sort of beyond the horizon where we can use the linguistic data productively. There is another linguist, Johanna Nichols, who has argued that the Americas must have been settled at least 30,000 years ago based on the distribution of grammatical forms. And I think that's just a non-starter. I mean, English and German are not very similar grammatically, but they only split at about 600 AD. So...
So there are a couple of sites that are closest contemporary. I think they're about 11,000 radiocarbon BP. On the Peruvian coast, a couple of those Cape Breton sites that have a lot of
marine
fish and so on. Mm-hmm. If you've had any thoughts about those, just because it, you know, certainly it's not pre-Clovis. The dates are similar, but the adaptation is radical.
Right. Cape Breton Hagwai and Cape Breton Takawai. Actually, there was just an article in Science last week by the guys who worked on Quebrada Jaguay. They've been up in the Andes and looking for the sources of obsidian that was found at the coastal site. And lo and behold, there are fishtail points up in the mountain areas where the obsidian is coming from. Also, the dating is something that has to be looked at with some precision. There are 11,000 radiocarbon dates at Quebrada Jaguay, but Sandweiss and company have suggested those are probably sort of old wood. The good date there is about 10-7, so it's comfortably post-fishtail or late fishtail. And Quebrada Santa Julia, coastal site, horse butchery, dates of 11,000, 10,900. And I think clearly relatable to the larger Clovis tradition.
I think that relates also to that notion that they're, you know, opportunistic foraging, depending on just what they have available. They're not
right.
These, you know, these big game hunters.
Look, I also think that there's probably sexual division of labor. You know, the kids are out whacking muskrats on the head. The women are collecting fish and shellfish, and maybe the whole group is going out netting waterfowl in season.
Even things like tortoises. I know there was a piece in American Antiquity maybe 3 or 4 years ago that said, you know, if you take an optimal diet model, yes, the big game are always going to be in the optimal diet, because if you bring down one of these, you get a hell of a lot of meat. But the other thing that should be there that you're seeing at some of these sites are big tortoises.
And actually, big tortoises go extinct also,
yeah.
In the same episode. I think an advantage of big game hunting is... kind of strangely, across the Americas, there are either the same animals or close analogs from one end of the continent to the other. Right, so there were giant ground sloth in Beringia and at Tierra del Fuego and in Florida. There were elephant varieties from the north to the south tip. There were horse in Alaska and horse in Argentina. So rather than try to eat plants, which God knows which ones are going to kill you. Remember that movie, what was it, Into the Wild, where the guy ate the wrong seed in central Alaska and poisoned himself? Why not go with the big animals? You know how to kill them, and they're all over and seemingly inexhaustible, although they found out otherwise.
When it comes to hunting, we've also slightly ethnographic. You know, you do have to tie in things like, you know, the social prestige of hunting certain animals.
Not so easy to get a mammoth. Yeah.
The question in the back mentioned waves of migration. So I understood your presentation to say no. One crew of 150 people, and based on if you trace back the people, you know, through clades and all this sort of thing. So that's what is accepted in science now. It's one group, no waves.
No multiple waves.
But also, to be clear, you are not saying that Clovis
cutting technology was brought over. You definitely feel that it was invented in America.
Yeah. Why? Well, but that, again, at a much earlier date, we're talking at Atapuerca about Homo erectus and Homo heidelbergensis and 300,000-400,000-year-old stuff. I mean, look, to take something more relevant to the American case, there were multiple kinds of hominins in Siberia, which is something that has only recently become evident. One pinky from a bone of a pinky from Denisova Cave proved to be a totally unknown kind of hominin, sort of a sister to Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. But there were also Neanderthals at the same site. And then at about 40,000, there are Homo sapiens. Curiously, Native Americans apparently have almost no, if any, Denisovan material. The most Denisovan DNA turns up in Melanesians for some reason, which is very curious and as yet not well explained. Joel.
Yeah, could we just speak a little bit to, you know, what you think about the speed of the migration from Beringia down to southern South America, because it's a relatively short period of
time. Absolutely, it's very fast.
Any explanation for that?
Eskimos move very fast too when they migrate. I mean, people move fast. You know, people can walk very fast. And in fact,
always in one direction.
Because there are people behind them.
Small group.
I mean, in fact, if you think about a kind of wave effect, right? If they start at the mouth of the Ice Free Corridor and they're kind of moving southeast, maybe that's why Darren Lowry is finding so much Clovis stuff, extraordinary amount really, in Delmarva. I mean, there are many more Clovis points in coastal Maryland than there are in Arizona, which is sort of the heartland of Clovis by classic conception. But maybe it's because that wave hits the coast and then there's nowhere left to go. So they sort of pile up there first. But there are people behind them. And they have to, you know, settle into that territory because there's no way back. I should address something that Pierre pointed out earlier, which is, I actually had a paper with Nicholas Pinter and John Keeley a couple of years ago suggesting that fire was a sign of the spread of Paleoindians across the landscape. And you do see a lot of these traces of fire about 13.5 to 13. Actually, the comet impact theorists like to say it's a giant wildfire caused by the comet smashing into somewhere maybe in the Laurentian ice sheet. But maybe it's the Paleoindian burning of the forest to facilitate their movement. I mentioned dogs. I think dogs help people to just carry stuff, and that facilitated movement. And if you do there's a classic example of an island off Australia where Birdsall documented, you know, like one guy and three young women went out to the island, and you know, 50 years there were sort of 30 people there. Right? I mean, humans have an intrinsic growth rate that's like triple per generation. And if you just use double per generation, and in about 600 years, you can fill the whole continent with somewhere between 1 million and 10 million people, starting with 150. You do it on your fingers, and it works out. Yeah?
So what is behind the holding pattern at Malta in Siberia for that 25,000 BP? They're just hanging around, whereas they have this enormous capacity, or later Clovis people have this enormous desire or hunger for large, big game animals, and that they and somehow the Siberians couldn't conform to this pattern of they're just holding tight there, and not doing anything, they're not going on excursions out to.
I think we have to look for kind of social and ideological reasons for that. I mean, I suggested years ago that maybe there was a bird shaman in Central Alaska, and when you know they had a bad season, he said, "Hey, let's go where the birds are. I have a vision." I mean, these things happen. Think of the Israelites going through the Red Sea. What drove them? This is a mythic episode too, but. And to be clear, I mean, they weren't just, you know, the Siberian people were hunting large game also. but it, probably they had to keep retreating because of climatic effects, and so there was a refugium left in the far north for the mammoth for quite a while, where people just weren't getting at them.
Well, I'm just struck by the it feels like a contradiction. On the one hand, people are willing to opportunistically exploit any possibility, and at the other hand, they're holding back. Perhaps a crucial factor.
As I said, you know, historical contingency. You know, why aren't we speaking Chinese? Because, you know, the Chinese would have wiped out any Portuguese fleet that came at them in 1450, but they didn't go around the horn.
No, because the Dutch were there.
Yeah.
I seem to recall from linguistics that this is probably one migration. Alut and the Dene languages are considered, or were considered, rather different from the Amerindian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And wouldn't that indicate separate groups?
Well, yeah, okay. You know, unfortunately, this is something that gets muddied in the literature these days. There was one migration of Amerindians. Then there are probably at least three separate later, strictly northern Arctic migrations. So there are the Dene, there are the pre-Dorset or Arctic small tool tradition, people who have also been genetically characterized as different from the later Eskimos. And then there are the Thule Eskimos who sweep across at about, now it looks like 1100, 1200 AD.
What are the dates of their separate groups?
Arctic small tool tradition is about, I think, 4500. The Thule ancestors of Inuit is about 1100, 1200 AD. And it's hard to say exactly when the Athapascans came up. That's something that still has to be worked on. But probably on the order of 6,000-7,000.
So what about the Goodyear's?
Not good. I wanted to correct you on that. Goodyear is talking about Topper.
The Topper.
Yeah.
What did I say?
Cactus. Well.
Oh, yeah, okay. The Topper site.
Yeah.
40-centimeter sterile zone between Clovis and.
Topper.
Was it Topper or Cactus Hill?
No, Cactus Hill. There's 3 inches of sterile between Clovis and the other stuff. And it's not really that sterile because there's also archaic stuff below it. At Topper, there's a nice Clovis horizon, and then there's this broken junk that's down below it. And almost nobody believes those, even the pre-Clovis advocates, accept that the lower stuff at Topper is artifactual. Forget that. Forget Topper. Even Goodyear, I mean, he and his students, the grad students working there, they're doing a nice job now on this nice Clovis workshop with a date of about 10,950, unsurprisingly. And they're kind of ignoring that lower stuff, which is a good thing.
We'd like to thank you so much, Stuart, for a wonderful talk tonight, and to Peter for your discussant remarks. And thank you very much.
Thank you.